Good Wednesday morning. Welcome into the 9 o'clock hour. I'm Kevin Dietz. Welcome to All Talk. Let's get through some headlines. In a striking revelation, it was confirmed that former President Joe Biden had not undergone a PSA test since 2014 when he was serving as vice president and was 72 years old. That was 7 years before he became president. During his 4 years in the White House, Biden received annual physical exams, but none included a standard PSA testing. That decision was based on medical guidelines advising against routine prostate cancer screening for men aged 70 and older. Biden has been diagnosed with stage 4 prostate cancer that has already spread to his bones. The diagnosis revealed a Gleason score of 9 in a grade group of 5, indicating an aggressive and fast-growing cancer. The U.S. Preventative Service Task Force recommends that men aged 55 to 69 make an individual decision about PSA testing with their doctors, but it does not recommend the test for men 70 and older. The rationale is that prostate cancer in older men often grows slowly and may not pose a significant health risk. Moreover, screening at that age carries the potential for harm, including false positives, overdiagnoses, unnecessary biopsies or treatments, and anxiety. Still, Biden's diagnosis, triggered only after he developed urinary symptoms and a nodule that was discovered on his prostate, it really raises questions about whether the current screening guidelines adequately protect older patients, especially those in high-profile and high-responsibility roles. Biden, now 82, is being treated for the most advanced stage of prostate cancer. Though medical professionals emphasize that skipping PSA tests was consistent with top-tier care, some other experts note that finding prostate cancer at such an advanced stage is really, really uncommon in the modern era. Still, other oncologists say Biden received appropriate care under current standards. Dr. Michael Morris, he's a prostate cancer specialist at Memorial Sloan Kettering, said he could be receiving the best medical care that we have to offer as a nation and still not be screened for prostate cancer. Excellent care means not under-testing. It also means not over-testing. Biden's most recent physical as president was conducted in February 2024. His physician, Dr. Kevin O'Connor, described him at the time as healthy, active, robust 81-year-old male who remains fit to successfully execute the duties of the presidency. That report made no mention of PSA testing or prostate issues, but did note his sleep apnea treatment and joint stiffness caused by arthritis. The late-stage diagnosis is raising questions around cancer screenings in older Americans. It's already drawn political attention. Vice President J.D. Vance criticized the lack of transparency and suggested that the American people need to be honest about Biden's health and his ability to lead. What I've not been able to find in any of the reporting, and I've looked at a lot of it, is what were the results of Joe Biden's PSA test back when he was 72 years old, the last time he was screened for PSA? Did it come back completely clean, a low number that there was nothing to worry about, nothing to watch? Or was it a number where they said, oh, we'll just keep an eye on it? If it was that, it's really surprising that he wouldn't continue to have screening tests moving forward. So maybe he got a clean bill of health at 72, and over the next 10 years, he did not have any testing, and he got a very aggressive prostate cancer, because for it to spread that quickly to get into the bones that way is, it's unusual. Usually you will find out about it. I don't know. So Laura Hessen is with us this morning. Laura, should we be just, letting this go and saying we wish Joe Biden well and good luck, or should there be, a more thorough investigation to find out, or should we look at legislation for presidents of the United States and vice presidents of the United States to say, this is what everyone's going to be tested for, this is who's going to know about which results, and really clarify it, because we don't really seem to have a very clear issue on the president's health. It's always a battle, no matter who the president is, to try and find out what their health is.
I think you just hit it on the head there with there's going to be uncertainty. And I think because there was so much uncertainty when he was president that we're not sure what else was hidden. And I'm sure it's happening in other administrations, and it has happened in other administrations, but because it was so visible that there was some form of decline with President Biden, that there's so much uncertainty. And I think that's why this is such a topic.
I think so, too. I think if this was the only issue, this would not be as big of an issue. But because this Tapper book has come out and they interviewed 200 people and they said that there were clear signs that Joe Biden was slipping and that the administration was hiding it, that people are like, well, what else might they be hiding? And because a PSA test, by the way, no big deal. It's just a simple blood test. It's no big deal. It's super easy to do it. When they talk about the harms, potential harms of a PSA test for people over 70, look, if you get a false score, it can certainly cause anxiety, and nobody wants anxiety. But if you get a false score and it says that you have a problem, you go in and you have a biopsy, and the biopsy gives you an absolute accurate assessment of what's going on. So if it was a false score, you'd know it immediately after a biopsy. Now, look, nobody wants to have a biopsy, but it's not, you know, it's not a dangerous procedure. They happen every single day. They go in, they test the cells, and they tell you what's going on. So like the risk versus reward doesn't make much sense to me there. I would think you would go in and have the PSA. And if there's a problem, you have the biopsy. If there's still a problem, then you can decide whether you want to do something about it or not. And the older you are, the less likely you are to do something about it. I personally don't think that we need to know about a president or vice president's prostate situation, because it doesn't affect your mental ability. It doesn't affect your ability to do your job. It doesn't really have any physical problems other than, having to go to the bathroom, not something that's going to preclude you from doing your job as the president of the United States. So I'd like them to just get some clarity on what we should be testing for and what should be public and what should not be. And I feel terrible that if Joe Biden missed an opportunity to catch this earlier, in his 70s, and they might have been able to do something for him. Now that it's spread to the bones, it's just really, really impossible to stop it. Radiation, chemo, all of those things. Once it's in the bone, it's really, really difficult. If you've been through this journey, by the way, I want to discuss it, you can give us a call at 1-800-859-0WJR. Donald Trump doubled down on Biden's inability to run the country as more information comes out from that book written by reporters. He says on True Social, he says, Joe Biden was not for open borders. He never talked about open borders where criminals of all kinds, shapes, and sizes can flow into our country at will. It wasn't his idea to open the borders and almost destroy our country and cost us hundreds of billions of dollars to get criminals in this country through the process. So he's saying it was the people that knew he was cognitively impaired and that they took his auto pen and went to work and they stole the presidency of the United States and put us in great danger. Donald Trump says this is treason at the highest level. Treason. Should that be investigated? Should we find out more about the auto pen and who was making the decisions and who was running the country? And was it treason if they did it without the public knowing? It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. 1-800-859-0957. 1-800-859-0WJR. You can give us a call or give us a text. Before we get to our next topic, I want to finish up what we were talking about with Joe Biden and his prostate cancer, because Poppy from Northville has called with a little information. Hey, Poppy, welcome to All Talk.
Good morning. I am a advocate of prostate cancer, and so the in-office biopsy that you were speaking about is actually not very accurate, and it can cause bleeding and uncertainty. Unfortunately, 90% of insurance companies require that in-office biopsy before they can go to the best thing, which would be an MRI-guided biopsy, and that definitely gives 100% results that aren't iffy. So our standard of care for prostate cancer isn't simply doing a PSA, and in older people, it can cause the biopsy in and of itself can cause issues. So we're very behind in treating prostate cancer for men. And if every man could have the PSA done and then have an MRI-guided biopsy, I think that we would save a lot of men and we would have saved our past president.
Tell us a little more about the uncertainty of the biopsy, because my understanding is in a biopsy, in-office biopsy, they will go and they will they'll get samples, about a dozen samples of the prostate, which is about the size of a walnut, and then they'll look at each of those samples and determine how much cancer or a Gleason score or whatever is in each of those samples. Where does the uncertainty come there?
Okay, so if you hold up a walnut and you take a needle and you are in an office, remember, you're not sleeping, and that needle goes into a straight object, how does the needle get to the back of the object? It cannot. It is limited by just physics and the physical, how, if you take something circular and you enter it with a straight needle, how are you getting the biopsy in the back of the prostate? That's the visual.
Yeah.
And therefore, you can get 12 samples from the front of the prostate and get zero from the back of the prostate.
Okay, that so... So get right to the MRI if possible. Figure out if we can get away. The MRI is probably more expensive, which is why they have you go the other route. Let's go to Mike and Troy. He had prostate cancer. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Kevin. I went through the typical year after year PSA tests, and they were always hovering around one-ish points, and then they started to climb in about a six-month period. Up into twos and then into the upper threes. My doctor felt a hardness during a digital exam, and he said, you need to go get an MRI. And I did, and they came back and said, you need to go get a biopsy. And they did that, which wasn't pleasant, but whatever. And anyway, bottom line is I had a Gleason score of between 6 and 7, and I had it removed in September a couple years ago, and I'm fine ever since.
What age were you, Mike?
I was at the time 66.
66, yeah. So I know at different ages, everyone's individual, different ages, they have different options and different decisions to be made. Real. Thank you very much for sharing that. If other people would like to call in and share their story, give us a call at 1-800-859-0WJR. I want to turn your attention now to this crazy New Orleans prison break. It sounds like a Hollywood script, this jailbreak, a secret hole behind a toilet, and a rogue maintenance worker helping them to escape. It's a real-life story out of New Orleans where 10 inmates, many accused of violent crimes, escaped from jail in what's being called one of the largest jailbreaks in recent U.S. history. Now serious questions are swirling about whether this was just a lapse in security, an inside job. Let's bring in Steve Dolan, retired Detroit Police Assistant Chief. Good morning. How are you?
Very good. How are you?
What a wild story. To see the video of this hole in the wall behind the toilet, it's like, Shawshank Redemption or something like that.
Escape from Alcatraz, the whole nine yards.
Sure.
But that's a jail, not a prison. There's a difference.
Right.
So it's a lot easier.
We had that.
Not that it makes a difference. But.
Were you around in Detroit when we had the jailbreak and about a dozen people went over the fence?
I believe so, yeah. And now, again, minimum security. It wasn't, and they took off. They caught them, but still. Don't they catch like 90% of all the prison inmates that escape?
Yeah, it's really hard to stay on the run.
Yeah, sure it is. Yeah.
It really is. What are your thoughts as you look at this? Because you want to believe that these facilities are secure. Probably working with someone on the inside here.
Oh, no doubt. First of all, it's a thankless job being a corrections officer. These inmates are either trying to convince you that they're their friend, and on the other hand, they threaten you. And this guy, I don't think he's paid that much money. He turned the water off. They've been planning this for a while. There's 10 guys, and it's not like just you and me, our roommates, and like, let's break out. 10 people got out.
Right.
And they were able to fashion a tool to unhook all the plumbing. And this guy never thought to say, hey, there's a possible jailbreak. And none of the guards heard them sawing through the bars. I mean, give me a break. Pretty lax.
Yeah, it's really concerning, and to see
oh, yeah.
even once they once they got through that hole in the wall, they still had a journey to go. And it surprised me that they were, you know, able to continue until they were, you know, actually out in the open.
Off the loading dock, right? So there's cameras, there should be.
There were.
It's like, wasn't New York where Epstein was killed and the cameras just didn't work?
Right.
Now, here you got people apparently not watching the cameras, and five of the people still out are wanted for or convicted of second-degree murder. So they're desperate. They're out there. And my concern is this. When they first get out, you're looking for food and shelter. Okay. You know, it's nonviolent. But the longer you're out there, the more chance you're going to have interaction with somebody, and it could lead to a carjacking or some other violent act. And that's the part that concerns me, because they're desperate. There's five guys second-degree murder. In fact, didn't two of the attorneys that prosecute them took their families and left town because they're in fear of their life?
Yeah. Most of them go back to their neighborhoods, though, or some friend. They need help because you need some money, some clothes, things like that. So they have a list of places to be on the lookout for them.
Yeah, and because they feel safe there, and they can blend in. And initially, that's all they want to do is keep low and blend in. But someone's going to talk eventually, and they're going to upset somebody, whether it's a domestic thing. How come you didn't visit me enough in prison? Anger happens. The next thing you know, boom. I personally know of a guy that was in jail who got out and ended up the reason they caught him is because he had a domestic thing with his girlfriend.
Yeah.
He called the police and said, here's where he's at. So these people are desperate right now, and the people in charge of the jail need to find new jobs. And I think this other guy, there's got to be more than one guy that's going to be charged, I believe, as an accomplice on
yes,
the inside.
I think so, too. Yeah. Steve Dahl, sure. Retired Detroit Police Assistant Chief. Thanks so much. Crazy story. Really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah. Okay, man. Take care.
All right. Take care. Yeah. Boy, when people are that desperate, especially if you have such a serious charge that you're facing, you're not likely to turn yourself in. You're likely to keep running for as long as you can, and hopefully they can get them all caught without anyone getting hurt. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. The White House is pushing hard to get the one big, beautiful bill passed so that the president can sign it. This is White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt.
Despite desperate Democrat lies, the biggest beneficiary of this tax cut will be working class Americans and their families. Americans earning between $30,000 and $80,000 per year will pay about 15% less in taxes after this legislation is passed. And according to a brand new paper from the White House Council of Economic Advisors, the average family with two children's take-home pay will be up to $13,000 higher because of the increase in wages and reductions in tax obligations. The CEA study also said that the average overtime worker receives a tax cut of roughly $2,000. Again, this is great news for our nurses, our police officers, and all those who work overtime to make ends meet across our country. Put simply, President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill will be a boon for working class America.
Will it get done in its current form? Will anyone read the entire Big Beautiful Bill? Let's bring in Danielle Alvarez, RNC Senior Advisor. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. It's great to be on with you. And it's a tough act to follow a clip of Caroline Leavitt. How excellent is she?
She is on her game every day. Very, very impressive young woman doing a great job for the White House. You know, we really spent a lot of time over the last 4 years criticizing all these big bills that nobody reads, and they pass the bill and then we'd find out what's in them. Here we're doing it. Why do you think we're putting out a big bill that's going to be most likely not read in its entirety by anybody who votes for it?
Well, the first thing that I'm going to say is look at how transparently this conversation is happening. It's happening all over the country. Members of Congress are fighting for every inch to make this bill better. It is such a stark contrast from what happened in the previous 4 years under Joe Biden and Democrat leadership. We are having conversations about different parts of this bill, but most importantly, this bill will deliver on exactly what President Trump campaigned on, making permanent the Trump tax cuts, no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, no tax on Social Security recipients, and most importantly, making sure that President Trump's border security is permanent. So everything that we're talking about in this bill is something that President Trump campaigned on for the entire presidential election, and we've got to put that bill on his desk.
Yeah, it really is the reasons, along with the economy. I think it's why people voted for him, for these tax cuts and for the security at the border. I think those were the big issues. We also have this Golden Dome, which is not a surprise. Donald Trump said that during the campaign that he wanted to do this. It's expensive. I think they said $175 billion, but it could make us safer than we've ever been.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, I was in the West Wing recently talking to a colleague that I worked with on the campaign. And, you know, we were reminiscing, and it was so interesting. He said to me, Danielle, can you believe that the reason we're able to sprint through these first 100 days, signing the executive orders that the president has signed, pushing for this big, beautiful bill? I mean, the president was in the halls of Congress making sure to talk to Republican members about the importance of these tax cuts and the importance of this bill. Is something that was determined on the campaign. There's really no surprises from this president. He said he'd secure the border. He did that. We've seen border crossings drop from hundreds to thousands every month, and I believe the number reported by the Department of Homeland Security last month was 9. We've seen him talk about tax cuts. You just said it's getting done in the big, beautiful bill. We've talked about bringing peace through strength. We've talked about bringing hostages home. Everything that he's talked about, pulling the levers of tariffs to strengthen our economy, to make sure that middle-class American families thrive. We are seeing all of that get accomplished, and it's all happening transparently. We're seeing these conversations in real time and the way that Speaker Johnson's having to negotiate with different members of the party. I think that the reason Republicans will be so successful, and I hope that we will be successful in the midterms, is because we will have governed well and we will have delivered. I mean, what a novel concept. To deliver on the promises you made on the campaign trail.
Here's the only issue I have with it. It's the $3.5 trillion or so that's going to get added to the deficit. I'd like to see about $30 trillion reduced from our deficit. And maybe the president's going to sell enough gold and citizenship coins to offset the deficit. But are you worried about the deficit going up? Or is there just nothing we can do about that? Because it's not sustainable.
I think it's a concern for everyone in this nation. But one of the things that I heard, and, you know, I'm certainly not the expert on you know, fiscal and deficit reduction, but I heard Russell Vought from the president's administration say that this legislation would deliver the largest deficit reduction in nearly 30 years. I think it was since the 90s Balanced Budget Act, and it would secure $1.6 trillion in mandatory savings. Look, here's what I would argue. I certainly wish, and I'm grateful that every Republican is fighting for every inch to make this bill better. But the reality is if we do not pass a bill, it will be a large tax hike, probably the largest tax hike in U.S. history. So we need to make this bill as the best bill that we can. Again, I'm grateful for the transparent process, for the conversations that Republicans are having to fight for every inch to reduce the deficit as best we can. Here's the other thing that I'd point out, and this actually just popped this morning. We saw a couple of days ago the Daily Wire report that Border Patrol Union is praising the big, beautiful bill for the border security investments, with union leadership and union members saying that the bill provides a once-in-a-generation investment in border security. We know that that's a priority of the American people. We know that the border security and the economy are the reasons why this country delivered the White House for the president and delivered the House and Senate for Republicans. But the one that just popped this morning comes from Angel Families, who are urging Republicans to pass this bill and to secure our border, because they want to see change. They're on the front lines. Their family members died tragically at the hands of illegal aliens. And I think that it is important that we honor their legacies and pass this big, beautiful bill.
But if every Republican was in favor of this, it would pass, because we have the House and we have the Senate. But we're not sure that they're going to do that, because Donald Trump had to go to Capitol Hill and try and convince people. What will it take to convince enough Republicans to vote for it?
I think ultimately it will pass, because, again, as I said, if we don't pass this, it will result in the largest tax increase in American history. We have to make those Trump tax cuts.
Right. The alternative's terrible, but they could adjust it here and there to appease certain members of the Republican Party, right?
That's exactly right. And that's what we're seeing happen in real time. We saw that rules is coming together to make sure to tweak the bill. We saw Speaker Johnson announce certain provisions in the salt caps to make sure that we could work this with individual members who are still holding out. And again, as I said, very transparent process. And really, I am not surprised that President Trump is engaging in the way he is. He's a very hands-on leader. I got to see that firsthand working for him on the campaign. We got to see that in his first administration. He's a very hands-on leader. He's the best deal maker and negotiator in chief that we have. So I am not surprised to see him in Congress talking to members. Again, stark contrast from Joe Biden, who did a hide in the basement campaign in 2020 and really was not engaged and is the reason why we have so many failures and so many hardships that the American people are working through because of his disastrous administration. I am proud that President Trump is so engaged to make sure that Republicans pass his signature legislation to get it on his desk.
Danielle Alvarez, RNC Senior Advisor, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. 1-800-859-0957. Give us a call. Give us a text. Be a part of the show. 1-800-859-0WJR. A political and legal firestorm is unfolding in New Jersey. A freshman congresswoman is facing federal charges after a confrontation with ICE agents at a detention center earlier this month. What started as a protest turned into a chaotic scuffle. The story has drawn outrage from Democratic leadership and civil rights groups, raising questions about political retaliation, legislative oversight, and law enforcement accountability. Donald Trump says, break the law and you will find out what happens.
With the arrest of a congresswoman, Democratic congresswoman.
Oh, give me a break. Did you see her? She was out of control.
Did you address
her? Those days are over. The days of woke. The days of woke. No, I didn't. The days of woke are over. That woman, I have no idea who she is. That woman was out of control. She was shoving federal agents. She was out of control. The days of that crap are over in this country. We're going to have law and order.
Let's bring in Nicole Ambrose, former National Young Republican Chair and the GOP National Committee Woman for Maryland. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Great to be with you.
I appreciate you being here. What do you think happened there May 9th during that visit to the Delaney Hall facility?
All right. So this congresswoman, who I'm sure most of us had never heard of before, was welcome to go and, as a member of Congress, conduct her oversight activities. She was welcome to do that. She went with good old Bob Menendez's son, who he got elected to Congress, you know, before he, you know, was convicted last year as a New Jersey Democrat, and another member of Congress. But Representative MacGyver also brought with her a gaggle of press and the mayor of Newark. And the mayor of Newark tried to also get into that detention facility. He was told, no, sir, sir, you are not a member of Congress. Only they can go into this detention facility. This facility is being used for basically all these ICE detentions. When ICE is going out and getting these violent, criminal, illegal aliens, they're being put in this facility if they're coming from the Northeast. So, right, we want to make sure the bad guys stay locked away. We don't need them escaping like they did in Louisiana last week, right? We want these people locked up. This is not just a big party and a garden party. No, this is a secure facility. And what LaMonica does is instead wants her buddy to go with, doesn't care what the law is, and chooses to throw hands, throw elbows, grab officials. And so two of these officers have filed criminal charges against her. And MacGyver is now facing two counts of assaulting, resisting, and impeding both a Homeland Security investigative agent and an ICE officer. So long story short, Democrats apparently need a 101 crash course, and you're not supposed to assault people. You're especially not supposed to assault federal law enforcement officials. And I would also suggest don't assault local or state law enforcement officials either. And, you know, Hakeem Jeffries went on TV and said, oh, I'm drawing a red line. No one should cross the red line of filing charges against members of Congress. Instead, what he needed to do was stand up there and say, she was wrong. No Democrat should be assaulting people. We stand united with Republicans. We believe assault is bad.
How?
Since I don't think they're going to follow my advice, they might keep losing elections.
I don't think they're going to follow your advice either. But how is January 6th different from this in that they were protests, they got out of hand, people were arrested? Why would it be okay to arrest people in the January 6th protest and not to arrest the congresswoman in this protest?
You're absolutely right. And the answer is there's just a double standard. And it's wrong. And I think Americans have gotten sick of it. I think that is why there were such overwhelming results in the 2024 elections. And as long as Democrats keep providing this insanity on a daily and weekly basis where they think they are above the law, you know, they violently break the law and then try to play the victim card, I think Americans are sick of it. We want a level playing field. We want clear rules for everyone, and we don't want people assaulting people trying to think, you know, hey, I'm the elected elite, I can do whatever I want, you know, rules for thee but not for me. And I just think that's why we had such strong, stark results last fall. And until Democrats become a party, you know, with an ounce of common sense, I think they will continue to lose.
Now, the Newark mayor was arrested, and then the charges were dropped. The congresswoman, the charges are in place. To me, that sort of makes me think, oh, well, they're looking at these cases individually and making decisions, which is what should be done in the justice system. But it's not playing that way in the media.
Right. Alina Haba reported that she reviewed 20 different videotapes of the incident. And after reviewing the incident, apparently the mayor went in, and for 5 minutes there was a very hostile confrontation where he was repeatedly asked to leave and refused. He finally stepped outside the gate, and it seemed to be MacGyver that was really leading the charge against the officers. So I think my understanding is, based on the charging documents, that would be why it was dropped against the mayor, but why MacGyver, with her aggressive physical hostility, was charged. She could have just been charged for simple assault. She met all of the standards for that, which did not even is defined according to 18 U.S. Code 111 as forcibly assaulting, resisting, opposing, impeding, intimidating, or interfering with federal officers in performing their duties. Serious assault, which she was charged with, actually involves physical contact, which, as everyone can see in America, she was all over these agents, pushing, shoving, and apparently there was a lot of grabbing too. Can't do that to law enforcement officers. That's a big no-no. You know, apparently Democrats need an orientation 101 class in this.
Well, the public already does not support the Democrats going to bat for these violent, illegal migrants. The polls show that clearly. And here she is. That's basically what she was doing, going to bat for them. Then she gets in this kerfuffle. They weren't happy, with the whole January 6th situation either. Why do you think other Democrats are sticking up for her?
You know, Eric Swalwell went on TV and said, oh, based on this, we need to do more and assault more people is essentially what I interpreted his words to mean. That is the wrong direction for Democrats to go. As you just said, the American people do not support this. These Democrats are fighting harder for violent criminal illegal aliens than they would for any American. And it is so offensive. I don't care if you're in a blue district or a red district or a purple district. When our elected officials think it is smart and the good thing to do to fight for violent criminal illegals who rape, murder, sex traffic, instead of showing up to represent U.S. citizens, voting to give away our hard-earned taxpayer dollars put up criminal illegals in hotel rooms at $500 a night with meal plans and phones, where we have to work hard to pay all those bills.
She's finding out how serious it is, and we're all going to be watching very closely. Nicolae Ambrose, former National Young Republican Chair, appreciate you coming on. This is All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. Thanks for listening to All Talk on a Wednesday morning. Welcome into the 10 o'clock hour. I'm Kevin Dietz, along with Laura Hessen and Danielle Mason. George Wendt, best known for his role as Norm Peterson on the classic sitcom Cheers, passed away peacefully in his sleep at his Los Angeles home at the age of 76. His portrayal of the affable, beer-loving barfly earned him 6 consecutive Emmy nominations and endeared him to audiences over the show's 11-season run. Beyond Cheers, Wendt had a big career in television, film, and theater. He was remembered by co-stars and fans alike for his warmth, humor, and iconic. See, people my age, Laura, just hear that song and they instantly smile and they remember the show and they're taken back to a time of must-see TV. That was Thursday nights. Everybody sat in front of the TV. You didn't record things and watch them. You didn't binge things. You waited for the next week for the show to come. I'm sure you've seen Cheers and reruns, bits of it anyway.
I'm vaguely familiar, but not enough to have a lot of input.
Yeah, right. It's just one of those things. Certain shows, certain generations. Cheers was really just ran for over a decade. And people, it was must-see TV. People on Thursday nights, they sat down and got ready for Cheers. And it was a lot of fun. Really good show. Also ending their TV career, saying goodbye to a really good job and on a popular show is Mark Cuban has taped his last Shark Tank after an awful lot of big deals. He is saying goodbye to Shark Tank. A lot of love there for Mark Cuban. We had Julia Dixon on the other day. That was one of his final deals. She's a local kid, young woman from Bloomfield Hills originally, and she got a deal with Mark Cuban. So she'll still be working with him. All of the entrepreneurs who got deals will continue to work with Mark Cuban. But he is stepping aside, and some think he's going to run for president. I don't know if that's the case or not. But
get Julia on the phone and find out.
Yeah, she could call him up and see if he's doing this to run for president. Pretty big show, though, and pretty big move for him to move away. He's one of the richest people in the world as well, though, so he can afford to step back if that's what he wants to do. Let's turn to Steve Courtney, WJR sports analyst. Our NFL player is going to go to the Olympics for some flag football. What's going on, Steve?
Hey, good morning, Kev, group. Hello again, everyone. This chat brought to you by the Performance Remodeling Sweepstakes, the $100,000 window of opportunity sweepstakes. That, my friends, a lot of dough. Call 586-540-6000 or visit windowsroofingsiding.com for more details. The Performance Remodeling $100,000 window of opportunity sweepstakes. Don't forget about the hardworking men and women at Bill Brown Ford. You know my good friend Matt Garko. He and his team doing great things for you each and every day. Drive with the champions at Bill Brown Ford. Shop their TrueView inventory at BillBrownFord.com today. All right, Kev, owners' meetings in the National Football League going on in Minneapolis, and there was a resolution on board to allow NFL players to participate in the 2028 Los Angeles Olympics via flag football. Well, let it be known, the NFL's 32 owners voted to unanimously approve this proposal. The flag football resolution establishes rules and basic structure for how the NFL hopes to see the process work. This is subject to negotiations with the NFLPA and Olympics-related entities. Just a couple of bullet points here. What they're going to discuss, permission for any player under NFL contract to participate in tryouts, a limit of one player per NFL team on each national team participating, and allowing, in addition, a team's designated international player to play for his home country. Now, there are provisions also for injury, as you might suspect. A purchase of league-wide insurance policies to provide injury protection for any player injured while participating in an authorized flag football activity related to the Olympics, not to mention a salary cap credit for any player who is injured. So I know there's a lot of folks tuned in, Kev. Their kids play flag football. They could be future Olympians. All right, your Detroit Lions, speaking of the league meetings, have withdrawn their resolution for postseason reseeding. Speaking of the Honolulu Blue and Silver, their preseason slate is now written in stone. They open exhibition play, of course, against the Los Angeles Chargers, Jim Harbaugh, in the Hall of Fame game. That'll be 8 o'clock now on July 31st at Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton. They will then visit the Atlanta Falcons at 7 o'clock on August 8th, which is technically week one of the preseason. You know, by participating in the Hall of Fame game, the Lions will have an extra preseason tilt. And then they will close the preseason with home games against the Dolphins on Saturday, August 16th, and the Texans on Saturday, August 23rd. Interesting enough, both those tilts will be 1 o'clock start. Interesting because the Lions have just 4 1 o'clock Sunday starts on their regular season schedule. Because why? Well, because the league loves them, and they have 5 primetime games on Thursday, Sunday, or Monday night. They also have holiday tilts on Thanksgiving and Christmas. So there you go.
What? How are they going to get these guys to try out for flag football? These guys are making, I don't know, $50 million a year quarterback, and they're going to say, hey, you can try out for the team?
Well, it's interesting because Justin Jefferson, the fine wide receiver of the Purple People Eaters, the Minnesota Vikings, Kev, he is indeed an international ambassador for flag football. And he says it would truly be a dream to participate and win gold. So I think there's going to be a lot of interest from NFL players to participate in this thing. And as I mentioned, there is some criteria as it relates to injury. Now, you may have some NFL players saying, look, I don't want to risk this, that, or the other thing for a flag football experience, even though it's the Olympic Games. So we'll see. I think the interest is going to be rather high.
Yeah, I think they're going to go eventually. If not this time, they will go eventually because it's like the basketball, deal. Eventually, you got to have your best players there. It's going to be fun to watch. I hope they go. It would be really cool. All right, Steve Courtney, WJR Sports Analyst, appreciate you.
All right, Kev. Have a wonderful day, my friend.
All right, you too. We are going to take a short break. You're listening to All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. The number is 1-800-859-0957. Give us a call. Give us a text. Be a part of the show. 1-800-859-0WJR. The Working Relations Index, now in its 25th year, gauges the health of relationships between Tier 1 auto suppliers and major automakers. This year's results tell a compelling story. Toyota, Hyundai, and GM are rising, while Ford, Stellantis, and Nissan are losing ground with potentially major consequences for cost, innovation, and resilience in an already turbulent global supply chain. Let's bring in Angela Johnson, principal at Plant Moran Management Consulting, for Supplier Relations Analytics. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I appreciate you being here. Tell us about the Working Relations Index. Who's surveyed? What kind of questions are they asked?
Yeah, the Working Relations Survey is in its 25th year, and it is a one-of-a-kind look at how the suppliers, the major suppliers in the auto industry, feel about their largest customers. So it started in 2001, and we've had the same OEMs right now since then. So there is Toyota, Honda, General Motors, and then Nissan, Ford, and Stellantis. And you nailed it. What it's really measuring is where do suppliers feel like they have the best relationship and where do they want to take their new technology?
So what are we reading into these findings? They seem a little surprising.
I'm not sure. I found them surprising, we'll say. I think what you're seeing is because we're in such economic stress right now, the industry's under stress, there's a lot of uncertainty, and suppliers are really buckling down on two things: their ability to manage their own costs so that they can deliver for their shareholders, and their ability to manage uncertainty, particularly where you look at Nissan, Ford, and Stellantis. There is a lot of uncertainty on their market position, who the leadership is going to be, what direction the company is going to go in. And what you see are the OEMs who came in that are more stable in the market, who already have strong relationships with their supply base, were able to do better. The ones that didn't have that position got worse among the uncertainty of inflation and tariffs and companies' market position.
So is it all that Toyota, Honda, and GM, they saw what was happening, they secured their supply chain, got it locked down when Ford, Stellantis, and Nissan weren't able to do that as well? Is it all about the supply chain and their ability to prepare for where we are today?
That is certainly a lot of it. It comes down to how well Toyota, Honda, and GM have done the hard work before they needed it. You have to have those relationships established so that when you have to go through a lot of turmoil, cost uncertainty, EV marketplace strategy is absolutely changing at a rapid pace. There's a lot of sunk cost, a lot of sunk capital. Add to that inflation pressures and potential tariff pressures. The OEMs who do a better job of collaboratively working with their supply base to share those costs and risk find themselves in a much, much better position and a more attractive position for suppliers to want to work with them.
But this isn't just about switching administrations from a Biden to a Trump administration and all the things that Donald Trump has been doing, right? Because like Toyota, to me, it seems like Toyota was the one company that said, look, we're not going all in on EVs. We're gonna go hybrids. We think the purchasers are going to want to transition slowly from gas cars to hybrids, then to EVs. And I think that's what ended up happening. So they got it right. Does that help them when it comes to being in good shape supply wise and whatnot?
Yeah, it absolutely does. I agree with you, not the Trump administration as much as people might think it is. Think of the timing of the survey. We issued it at the midpoint of February to the beginning of April. Tariffs hadn't really hit the conversation as hard as they are now. Suppliers were really dealing with the ramifications of the EV adoption not taking off like most of the OEMs thought it would. So they geared up both in terms of hiring the right engineers, getting the right tooling and equipment in place, and preparing the right capital to be able to support programs that never materialized.
So GM, according to your findings, jumped 86 points over the last decade. That's the biggest improvement of any automaker. What did they do? Did they change their culture? What did they do to get it to a point where they have been on the upswing for a decade?
They have. I believe General Motors is knocking at the door of a real culture change. You know, Mary Barra drove a culture change for safety. Culture is extremely difficult to turn around. They've done it before, though. They've showed us in their safety culture. I believe you're seeing the purchasing department under the leadership of Steve Kiefer, Shilpan Amin, and now Jeff Morrison really take on the same kind of values, the same desire to build those relationships at the marketplace, and they are truly starting to turn the ship. They've got a long way to go. When you look at their data, they get the best of the best feedback. Suppliers want to get them their top talent, but they also get some of the worst of the worst. They are still those persistent old school GM behaviors that everybody talks about that aren't fully out of their culture yet, but they're definitely going in the right direction.
Does a good working relation index score translate into better sales, better profits?
Well, let's look at that a couple of ways. That is a really great question. Suppliers will choose where to market their technology. So as they're out there developing the latest and the greatest tech and features and designs that the customers want to see, they're looking for the right partner to shop that technology to be first in the market. When you think about the fact that 60 to 80% of a vehicle's content comes from the supply base, being the OEM that suppliers want to work with definitely can give you an edge up in sales because you'll be providing that new technology that everybody wants to buy. We do see that it correlates to the OEM's financial performance. What it really does is it lowers their operating cost. when you've got a better relationship with the supply base, you are going to better work through supply chain issues, keep your plants running, have better talent on launch support, and essentially it's going to help the OEM lower their operating cost, which does improve their financial position.
We talked about GM shooting up 86 points over the last decade. Ford, on the flip side, dropped 70 points in the last 10 years. Can they turn that around? How long does it take to turn the ship around?
I think they can turn it around. What I noticed about Ford, and you got to look real hard at the chart, but between last year and this year, they still went down, but they didn't have that steep decline that we've really seen in them since 2020. I believe they will start to put in some of the elements, some of the focus on these supplier relationships. They can absolutely turn that down. They've been in third place before. There's no reason they cannot change their trajectory and come right back up into the middle of the pack.
Do you think investors look at this index?
I do. We do have some that reach out for comments, so I know they're looking at that in the media, which tells me the investors are wanting to see where those solid relationships are because they know the benefits that it brings the OEM. The OEMs cannot deliver top market vehicles without strong relationships in their supply base.
All right, Angela Johnson, Principal of Plant Moran Management Consulting for Supplier Relation Analytics. Thanks for bringing us the inside details of the Working Relations Index. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. It was fun. Thank you so much. Toyota, Honda, and GM are rising. Ford, Stellantis, and Nissan are losing ground. They're going to want to pay attention to the charts and see if they can't turn this around and get a better relationship with the OEMs. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Kevin Dietz. This is All Talk. It's your money. You're the one that pays the bills with your tax dollars. Do you ever get tired of the fraud and abuse? Government-issued credit cards, they're meant for official business. So why are they being swiped at casinos, nightclubs, even dating services? A new report reveals shocking abuse of taxpayer funds by federal employees, especially at the Department of Defense. Senator Joni Ernst and Congressman James Comer are demanding sweeping reforms, and they want answers as Americans struggle with inflation and a $36 trillion national debt. It sort of looks like Washington might be partying on our tax dollars. Let's bring in Mike Rogers, veteran, former FBI agent, chairman of the U.S. Intelligence Committee, and a Republican Senate candidate. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Kevin. How are you, sir?
I am doing just fine. I'm never happy about paying taxes, and then I'm really unhappy when I think there's abuse with the tax dollars that we do pay. I don't like the idea of people at the Department of Defense maybe having a gambling problem either. I think that could put them in a precarious position if they have access to our defense secrets and they have problems at the casino. But what do you look? Is this a big deal about nothing, or is this a big deal? Should we be using government credit cards at nightclubs, casinos, and dating services? Is there a realistic explanation for that?
No. And so I'm going to call the red flag on some folks. I've heard them say, well, you know, because they're doing recruitments and other things. That is just absolute nonsense. There's two credit cards per employee in the federal government. That needs to end. A credit card could be something that you check out from your supervisor if you have a project that you need to get out and get the materials and then get back to work and then submit the bill a month later. That seems okay to me. But just to hand these things out. And if you looked at, there's almost 4,000 different kinds of transactions or cards that were used on holidays in Las Vegas. I mean, it's clearly, casinos and bars and strip clubs. And I mean, that is clearly just an abuse and it's maddening. And what it tells me is there's just no accountability over the people who are running those cards through. Matter of fact, apparently at one of the hearings this week, the people even said, well, we don't really have a good way to monitor this. What? I'm sorry, what? And so what you need to do is take that. You just need to take them away. There's another way you can do this. And the other one was, well, they could use it for this development, like source development and all that. Well, I'm going to also say absolute nonsense. what you those accounts, those credit cards would never be tied back to the Department of Defense anyway. It would be a special category assigned to a special case that had its own special funding that is audited. This is just apparently not even audited. I mean, it's just another example of the gigantic waste that happens in Washington, D.C., and why you need to eliminate both, you know, jobs that just don't need to be there anymore. You know, the average job, Kevin, in Washington, D.C. now pays over $100,000, federal employment in D.C.
Wow.
$100,000. And, you know, you can't have 10 people operating a fax machine anymore at the SBA. You can't have credit cards running around just ringing up strip club stuff and gambling. And by the way, you're right, that does make people vulnerable to recruitment by foreign agencies if you're working in a sensitive agency like Department of Defense. I mean, all of this is bad. I can't find anything good in it. And the only good thing is that they're on it, they're going to fix it, and it's long, long overdue.
Yeah, you have those credit cards in your purse or wallet, and the temptation to use them is going to increase. And then you do use it for something that you think, well, maybe this is a gray area. This I could probably explain this if I had to, and nobody ever comes and asks you about it. Then you're like, all right, you just move that gray area along, and suddenly you're using a card, and nobody's ever asking you about the expenses. They just keep going through, and you start spending more and more of taxpayers' dollars that you shouldn't be spending. The idea of checking out a credit card would be wonderful. Corporate world, they stopped that. They said, you spend your own money, and then come back and tell us why you want to be reimbursed. That gets you to stop spending in a hurry.
Yes, it does. Absolutely. And I don't think that's a bad idea necessarily either. You could see really rare occasions that you have, you know, you got to run and get cables for a computer system that you've moved to a different place, you know, or whatever. I don't know. You could probably find an example somewhere, but it's rare. It should be the exception, not the rule. Just handing out these cards is dangerous, number one, and obviously very, very wasteful. And candidly, I would go through the bosses and the supervisors who have never looked at these things, probably shouldn't be bosses or supervisors. If they don't understand that's not their money that they have to manage, then maybe they shouldn't be there either. I just think we have to – this is a huge opportunity with Donald Trump and a Republican-controlled legislature to finally put some accountability back in these agencies. It just hasn't been there in forever. And guess what? You as a supervisor are responsible for taxpayer dollars. This isn't free money. And the fact that they're just – I mean, you looked at some of the charges that they uncovered. It's just shockingly bad. You know, if you're spending money on New Year's Eve, you know, at 10 o'clock on – I'll guarantee you, and we call that a clue, something good ain't happening.
Something good ain't happening. Yeah, you got all these jobs, all these people making six figures. You think it could be somebody's job to make sure that all of these charges are checked. The lack of oversight bothers me a lot, because we saw with Doge just how many areas there really is no oversight. And with the technology today, it just seems to me there really is no excuse for it. If there's no oversight, to me it says somebody doesn't want the oversight.
Exactly. And they didn't want the responsibility. I mean, one of the problems with the federal government is they promote these people into jobs who candidly, clearly are not capable of having hard decisions, like telling somebody no. And, you know, supervisory jobs are never easy. That's why, you get a little extra money to do it. They just did not want to be engaged in telling people, what are you doing on your credit card? Maybe you shouldn't be doing that. And by the way, if you're doing those kind of expenditures, you know it's wrong. Do you really want them in a position of authority at all in the federal government? I don't care what you do, whatever your portfolio is in Department of Defense. I'm going to say probably not. You need to move along. Go find something else to do. If you knowingly violated not only rule, I think there's some laws in there as well. And it's just like stealing. And if you think it's okay to steal, I don't want you to have access to any material that our adversaries could get their hands on. I mean, I would be pretty tough on this. They need to go through and clean this out. They need to take all those cards back. It's really ridiculous that they all have them.
Mike Rogers, veteran, former FBI agent, chairman of the U.S. Intelligence Committee, and Republican Senate candidate. Thanks so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Hey, Kevin, it's great to be here. I knew you missed me.
I did. Love having you on the show. Thanks for running. Good luck with the campaign.
Thank you, sir.
We will be in touch for sure. Yeah, if they're using government credit cards for the Super Bowl and UFC fights and Cinco de Mayo parties and casinos and nightclubs and dating services, they're so brazen to do that, and they're not really worried about getting caught. Think about all the millions, billions probably, of dollars that were spent on stuff that are more in the gray area. You know, just buying ink for your printer at home, whatever. They just don't seem to care that they're spending your money. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. The number is 1-800-859-0957. Give us a call. Give us a text. Be a part of the show. 1-800-859-0WJR. Republicans are slamming federal agencies for wasting taxpayer money on all kinds of things. We're talking about a $1 trillion deficit that is going on out there. And we're talking now about a big, beautiful bill that could add $3 trillion to the deficit. But it would also secure the borders. There's a Golden Dome and many other things. Will Republicans go for it? Let's bring in Jared Halpern, a Fox correspondent and WJR contributor. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. And the question's not will Republicans go for it, but will more than four, I guess not. That's kind of what we're watching in the House, because that's the margin, right, is, a margin of four that House Republicans can lose. President Trump made it used to be the walk to Capitol Hill, made the motorcade drive to Capitol Hill yesterday, joined House Republicans for their weekly conference meeting to make his sell and kind of put the pressure on, right? I mean, he's been very critical and says that Republicans now need to get in line. We're singled out some Republicans who have been no's up to this point, some of those holdouts, calling them out by name, suggesting that they could face, tough re-election if they don't go along with this. And that's the pressure, right? And for some of these Republicans, that is a real concern. I think for others, less so. But, there is also a group of Republicans who have kind of stood firm on a lot of these big spending bills and have suggested this is not the type of spending bill that President Trump ran on, that they ran on, and they're going to hold the line. You had a group from New York and California, some of these bluer states, these really majority-making Republicans, when you look at what swing districts are, right? Folks like Mike Lawler, who's a Republican from kind of the northern suburbs of New York City. It is a congressional district that he won and that Kamala Harris won. There are not many examples of that. And his point is, listen, the SALT and local tax deductions are something that the president said he would restore. He wants them restored at a level they previously were. That agreement seems to be worked out. The problem is, as you kind of make those concessions to one block, you're going to have another block that says, well, what are we getting, right? And now that's kind of where Speaker Johnson is with the more conservative Freedom Caucus folks, who said, well, you gave the moderates what they wanted. Here's what we want. And if you do that, does it take anybody else off the bill?
Yeah, the president came in and sort of was selling the idea that, look, the alternative is a disaster, the biggest tax increases ever, and that's fine. The congressional members, the Republicans, are saying, yeah, but we can whittle this thing down a little bit. It doesn't have to be as written.
I mean, and that's the
written.
Question, yeah. I mean, so the president is calling this one big, beautiful bill, which, by the way, I think is actually how it's being named in Congress at the moment. Which is fine. Bills Build Back Better became the Inflation Reduction Act. It had very little to do with inflation,
right?
At least reducing it. And the problem with these bills, and it was the same when President Biden tried to get through his big reconciliation package, is because you can get around the filibuster, because this is kind of your shot at getting things done with a simple majority when you have control of all three levels and you don't know how long you may have those levers, is you try and get a lot more in there, right? So this is not just about extending or making permanent the soon-to-expire tax rates that were put into place in 2017. It's about adding new tax policy, no tax on tips, no tax on overtime. It is about trying to create savings in Medicaid, which is always controversial when you talk about work requirements or who's eligible and who's not. It is about new money for the border, less controversial, but something that, again, raises deficit numbers. And so that is what you do with these big bills. And so the president, this is basically the president's legislative agenda wrapped up in the one big, beautiful bill, the way that President Biden tried to get his entire campaign promise done in one big reconciliation bill. Now, you'll recall that what President Biden initially started with in Build Back Better was cut about in half at the end of the process because you had more moderate Democrats, namely Joe Manchin, who said, I am not going to sign off on spending this much money. And he was able to get in some pet projects of his own, a pipeline in West Virginia, things like that. And so that's the wheeling and dealing that happens. It's the nature of these types of packages.
But don't you remember when Joe Biden brought that bill forward that Republicans were screaming from the mountaintops that this bill is so big, nobody's even going to read it. No, it's, by the time it's presented, they vote on it without even reading it. How can you not? Now you're doing the same thing. How can you not be critical of them bringing this big bill that nobody's going to read?
Well, you're not suggesting a level of hypocrisy in the United States Congress.
Well, I'm going to surprise the audience to say that, but that might just happen out there occasionally.
but listen, Democrats are very critical that Republicans held this meeting at like 1 o'clock in the morning, and you know you're trying to pass it in the middle of the night. Where have we heard that before? but again, that is kind of the way that these big. And let's keep in mind that if this gets over the finish line this week, and that's the goal for Speaker Johnson, he wants the House to get done with their portion before Memorial Day, which they break for traditionally like tomorrow. We'll see kind of what that looks like. Then the Senate gets a bite at the apple and they're going to make changes. And what are they going to do? And is the House going to accept that when it comes back? So the process that we're in is kind of like the early middle stages of what finally could become this bill. But again, this becomes now a question when you're talking about margins of 3 or 4, depending on kind of what the population looks like, the attendance looks like. It means that small groups of Republicans hold an enormous amount of sway. And now the question is kind of, do they hold the line or do they acquiesce to the wishes of the leader of their party, President Trump?
So as they work through all of this, because the biggest problem for me is that it adds $3.5 trillion or something mm-hmm. to the deficit.
Republicans will tell you that it doesn't.
Okay.
Because they'll say that one part of that is raising the debt limit, which has to be done. And that covers previous spending, not future spending. They will also say that some of this CBO scoring is not dynamic enough, that it does not take into account that tax cuts will expand the economy, will expand growth, will bring in new revenue, and that it underplays the role that tariffs will play. I'm not saying what's right or wrong. These are 10-year measuring sticks, and sometimes they are accurate and sometimes they are not.
I guess what I'm asking, will this get more expensive because they have to give more stuff to get the final Republicans to vote, or will this get smaller because what they're asking for, what they're mad about is the spending?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to depend on kind of what. So one of the things that could make it more expensive is it sounds like there is a deal with the New York and California bloc on SALT deductions. So one thing that the original tax bill did in 2017 was it got rid of a federal deduction that you got in your federal taxes for state and local taxes that you pay. The New York, New Jersey, California Republicans all voted against the bill because of that. They want that cap restored. They want to be able to bring that deduction back to their constituents. President Trump said he was in favor of doing that.
Right.
That is something that will make, you know, one of the reasons that they got rid of it in 2017 was to help pay for the rest of the tax cuts, right? You have to make that up somewhere.
Right.
So conservatives are like, fine, if you're going to do that, where are you taking it from? And That's kind of the conversation that's underway now.
All right. Jared Helper, Fox News correspondent, WGR contributor. Thanks so much. Really appreciate you jumping on. All right. Yep. They're going to work on it. They're going to try and get all those Republicans to agree. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. Hope you're having a good Wednesday morning. Welcome into the 11 o'clock hour of All Talk. Kevin Dietz along with Laura Hessen and Danielle Mason bringing you the latest headlines. We were talking about the big, beautiful bill. It includes $175 billion for a Golden Dome. President Donald Trump has announced plans for a sweeping national missile defense system. He likes the name Golden Dome. It's aimed at intercepting threats from land, air, and even space. Modeled after Israel's Iron Dome, the initiative would deploy hundreds of satellites, sensors, and interceptors, and marks the first serious push to weaponize space since Reagan's Star Wars program. SpaceX, Peltier, and other companies are among the top contenders to build the system, with Trump promising completion before the end of his current term. This was Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth on the Golden Dome.
Mr. President, add this to the long and growing list of promises made and promises kept. Ultimately, this right here, the Golden Dome for America, is a game changer. It's a generational investment in the security of America and Americans. Mr. President, you said we're going to secure our southern border and get 100% operational control after the previous administration allowed an invasion of people into our country. President Reagan, 40 years ago, cast the vision for it. The technology wasn't there. Now it is, and you're following through to say, we will protect the homeland from cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, hypersonic missiles, drones, whether they're conventional or nuclear. It's not lost on me, sir, also, that you had the vision to start the Space Force, and here we are when the others said we didn't need it, here we are in the Oval Office with one of the leaders of the Space Force in General Guetlein leading the charge on putting in place a game-changing Golden Dome for America. So,
and this was Donald Trump on the Golden Dome.
In the campaign, I promised the American people that I would build a cutting-edge missile defense shield to protect our homeland from the threat of foreign missile attack. And that's what we're doing. Today, I'm pleased to announce that we have officially selected an architecture for this state-of-the-art system that will deploy next-generation technologies across the land, sea, and space, including space-based sensors and interceptors. And Canada has called us, and they want to be a part of it. So we'll be talking to them. They want to have protection also. So, as usual, we help Canada do the best we can.
All right, Laura, what do you think? $175 billion. Do you want a Golden Dome protecting you from anything that can be shot at us from land, sea, or space?
In theory, yes, but I don't think it's going to work like that.
You don't think the technology is going to work?
It just seems I don't know how to explain my thoughts on it. Like it,
they have it in Israel.
I know
the Iron Dome, but Israel's much smaller.
Yeah, that's why I don't think it's going to work. I don't know how to.
Too much area to cover?
Yeah.
They'll find holes in the Golden Dome.
There's going to be problems.
There'll be gaps.
Correct. And like, while I understand the intent behind it, is this just going to be another wall?
That doesn't work, you mean?
Yeah, that's not finished.
Well, it only wasn't finished because the Democrats came in and stopped finishing the wall. But if you're saying that they don't finish the Golden Dome or they dismantle it after because it's too expensive.
Yeah.
All right. That's fair enough. There's certainly history of, different parties coming in and changing priorities and spending money in different ways. I kind of like the
idea. When is it actually going to start getting built?
Well, no, they said it'll be done by the time Trump leaves.
Okay.
So if they said the wall would be done.
Correct.
By the Trump leaves as well, to your point. And he said Canada was going to help pay for it. But
I don't know that's true right now.
It's less money than we sent to Ukraine by far. I kind of like the idea of the dome. Not only because I'm afraid of missiles, I'm afraid of like space junk falling from the sky and hitting us. I want the Golden Dome to protect us.
Remember the mystery satellites? That was fun.
Until it falls in your backyard, then it's not fun. I don't know.
It's another fun day.
All right. I thought this was interesting as well. FBI Director Kash Patel, he stated that Jeffrey Epstein died by suicide based on his experience and review of the case. They also had Dan Bongino, who's the deputy director, the former Fox News guy. He reviewed the case, and he says the same thing. The assertion has been met with a strong opposition from Epstein's brother, Mark Epstein, who argues that Patel lacks firsthand knowledge of the circumstances surrounding his brother's death and suggests alternative possibilities. You remember the cameras, for some reason, didn't work, and then they found Jeffrey Epstein dead in his cell. But This was Kash Patel and Bongino on the Epstein death.
You said Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide. People don't believe it.
Well, I mean, listen, they have a right to their opinion, but as someone who has worked as a public defender, as a prosecutor, who's been in that prison system, who's been in the Metropolitan Detention Center, who's been in segregated housing, you know a suicide when you see one, and that's what that was.
He killed himself. I've seen the whole file. He killed himself.
All right, Laura, so now the Biden administration and the Trump administration both say that Epstein killed himself, but do you know what the conspiracy people are saying out there?
No, but I wonder if Danielle does.
Danielle?
She doesn't know either. This just seems like Danielle's jam.
They're saying that so many important, influential, and powerful people were on Epstein Island with underage women that both parties are willing to go along with the idea that Epstein killed himself to cover up, because both parties would go down because so many people would be on that list. What do you think?
I've been a little bit into the conspiracies lately. It's just been something that's been entertaining me. Not this big of one. However, I can't say I'd be shocked. It's large and it's far-fetched, but I wouldn't be shocked.
Yeah, the number of names that have popped up as and they have those logs, so they know like who was on planes and who was on Epstein Island, whether or not what they were doing there, we don't know. But Epstein supposedly had cameras all the time, everywhere, and if there is that kind of evidence, would both parties cover it up? I don't know. It'd make a good movie. I don't know if I'd believe both parties would cover it up or not.
I think if that were the case, it may be what's being said now, but eventually the truth will come out, which is why I don't know that I completely buy into it.
Yeah. We're going to have to wait, like the Kennedy assassination. Wait 50 years or so.
Yeah, who's going
to
drop
then
those
they'll
papers?
Then they'll release papers that don't get us any closer to the truth. One of those deals. All right. I thought this was also cool. It was Take Your Daughter to Work, and they did Take Your Daughter to Work at the White House press secretary.
Nora, go ahead.
Which is Donald Trump's favorite president besides himself?
Good question. Good question. Because it would be probably himself. No, I think that perhaps he would say George Washington. I know he speaks very highly of George Washington, who was, of course, the first president of our great country. And he has his big, beautiful portrait hanging in the Oval Office above the fireplace.
I think we have another one.
What is it like balancing a baby and your job as the press secretary as your age?
Sure. It's a very good question. And my baby is here with my mother. As you can see, he does not know what's going on. But it is a challenge every day. But it's also a blessing to have this opportunity and to be a mom. So you have to learn to prioritize your time and lean on your support system, which is my mother and my husband and my family and friends. And you can do it. You just have to work very hard.
Kind of like that, with all the heavy stuff that goes on in that room every day, all the battling and bantering. Bring your kids in and ask some questions.
Mm-hmm.
You like
it? It's cute.
It's cute. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. The number is 1-800-859-0957. Give us a call. Give us a text. Be a part of the show. 1-800-859-0WJR. Transparency in government. It's not a buzzword. It's a voter mandate. When the system designed to deliver transparency becomes a barrier instead, it raises serious questions. Today, we're joined by Tom Kuhn, state Republican from Troy, state rep, a Republican from Troy, to talk about the troubled rollout of the Michigan Transparency Network, why the system is under fire, and what the legislature may be able to do to fix it. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good. How about you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you for being here. What was the original purpose of the Michigan Transparency Network?
Well, according to the Secretary of State, to do away with the old software system and combine new abilities in the new system.
And what were we going to be able to monitor?
Well, supposedly they claimed they were going to be able to monitor everything, but obviously that has not happened.
Obviously. It is not going well for people who aren't following it. Do we know why it's going so badly? Is the system?
Let me just throw this out as a possible idea. The old software system for Secretary of State has been operated for the past 10 years by the same organization that was given the contract for the new software, Michigan Transparency Network. So only one bid was considered, even though the contract called for the new software called for oversight by the Secretary of State, including weekly meetings. That never happened. In fact, the Secretary of State named its project manager someone who has zero software development experience and is full-time on campaign finance, just to fill in the box. So a no-bid contract to the current vendor with no oversight. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, it's a recipe for problems. What is the Secretary of State saying about this?
Well, I mean, they're saying that they'll get it fixed by July.
Great. They're going to work some weekends, work nights, try and get this done.
They rely totally on the vendor. You know, they have nothing in-house to oversee the vendor. I mean, yes, now it's become a political liability for Jocelyn Benson. So she has her chief of staff involved on it and all their top people. But they don't have anybody in-house that can do this. So what do? They rely on the same vendor who has screwed everything up.
Do we know anything about the vendor, who they're related to?
Mean, again, well, I don't know, but they've, under different corporate names, they have been the vendor since 2014. And they were the vendor in the old system, they're the vendor in the new system, and they get a contract without any competition.
Yeah, so if a bid had taken place, how might this have gone differently?
Well, again, you have to have an RFP that actually allows other bids to, you know. We're trying to get the RFP. We believe it's important to see what exactly the Secretary of State said the vendor had to have, because why did it result in only one vendor? And yeah, it's a $9 million contract. Okay. This isn't just tiddlywinks. It could have gone better, but again, it seems like the whole process here is deeply flawed.
Yeah, it really does. Why do you think they actually went ahead with the launch if this critical system wasn't fully ready?
Well, you know, according to the Jocelyn Benson's chief of staff, they knew in December when they did the initial launch for the lobbyists that there were problems. But according to her, Benson said, full speed ahead. We need to get this done. So then they did this phase in, and, you know, it's been a disaster. It's gotten worse and worse and worse.
What are some of the problems they're having with the system?
Well, I mean, all the legislators are aware of the fact that we were supposed to do personal disclosures by May 15th. And what happened? Virtually no one could get online to the system. So this is really bipartisan right across the board. And you listen to the committee hearing, Republicans and Democratic legislators, we've all been through it. You can't get through. And it's it's a serious problem, because this has not just the personal disclosures, but all the campaign finance and all those other important items that people are required to report.
Yeah, we had a vote. We passed the proposal. We said we wanted these disclosures. There were deadlines for these disclosures to come in, and people sat down to do them, and they weren't able to because the system doesn't work. When you look at, I think Tyler Technologies is, I think, the contractor on this deal.
They're the current name, yes.
Yeah. Can you withhold their payments? Can you claw back money from them? Is there anything in the agreement that says they have to actually produce what they said they would produce?
You know, my problem is that there's no ability internally, apparently, at the Secretary of State to actually oversee this project. It should have had weekly meetings with somebody knowledgeable in technology, so that you don't come to December 2024 and find out that this situation, you know, this new software has serious problems. So are you asking if we stop them right now, what will happen? They own the old system as well. They're the ones who operated the old system. So what do we do? So it really seems like, you know, the Secretary of State's office is captured by this vendor who is the only one that they consider.
So what happens if they come back with this new supposed deadline when everything's going to be fixed by and it still isn't working? Do you keep throwing good money after bad money?
Well, you know, we'll wait and see on that. But, you know, we have another oversight committee with Chair DeBoyer's general oversight, and ours is an appropriations oversight committee, the general government, on June 24th. I mean, there's a, you know, we're doing whatever we can to try and get some understanding of why this is so screwed up and to get it back on track, because this is incredibly important information that we need.
A lot of voters feel like that proposal didn't go far enough in transparency. And as you well know, Michigan gets an F when it comes to transparency. We're the bottom two states in the country when it comes to transparency. And so we go through the effort to pass this little piece of transparency, and it doesn't get done. What does that do to the trust, the public trust?
Well, you know, again, there's obviously it's going to undermine public trust, no question about it, and hopefully it'll get fixed sooner or later. Hopefully sooner. I mean, the next major reporting time frame is at the end of July. That's why they're pointing to that time frame. Although the legislature voted nearly unanimously to extend our disclosure time frame from May 15th to June 13th, because we couldn't comply. We couldn't comply because of the website.
So in your opinion, does this lay at the feet of Jocelyn Benson? Was this her sole decision? She's running for governor. She could be held accountable by voters.
Well, she could be held accountable. I think she's responsible. She wanted to move forward with this, even after red flags were raised in December. And, you know, I'm sure her chief of staff would like to take the arrow instead of her, but she's the one responsible.
Any idea what it would cost taxpayers if we just cut ties with this company now and started over with somebody else?
I just don't see how that's happening, because the Secretary of State has only this vendor, and they allocated all the responsibility to this vendor. They have no oversight, in my humble opinion. Yeah, they have this chief of staff talking to the president of Tyler, but as far as day-to-day oversight of this program, they've already given it over to the vendor.
Yeah, the vendor's running the show. Tom Kuhn, state rep, Troy, Michigan, thank you so much for coming on and explaining the situation to us.
Thank you, sir.
That's Michigan transparency for you right there, boy. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. President Donald Trump made a rare and forceful appearance on Capitol Hill, urging House Republicans to unify behind his sweeping big, beautiful bill. Speaker Mike Johnson says we might get a vote today. Divisions remain, particularly over tax breaks, spending cuts, Medicaid reforms. Michigan Congressman Tim Walberg showed up at work at 1 a.m. this morning to work on the details. We had him scheduled for 9:18 this morning, but they were still working. He is able to join us now, and I'm sure he is very, very tired. Good morning, Congressman. How are you?
Well, I almost feel like a morning radio talk show host now.
Yeah, those hours on a regular basis could be painful. I'm glad you don't have to do it all the time. Just when it gets real important down to the wire. Where are we at? Is Mike Johnson right? Will we get a vote? Are we close enough?
Well, it remains to be seen. You know, I haven't heard any reports since I was in front of the committee for about 4 hours. So I haven't heard the reports yet, whether they think it is. I talked with Majority Leader Scalise yesterday, and he was very confident we'd have a vote by tonight. We'll see what happens. There's been a lot of negotiations going on. We're hearing that there might be a manager's amendment, which means that there'll be some additions, subtractions, amendments that are put on and will become part of the bill that we each passed in our 11 committees. to bring us to this point. So, like I said, I have only been in front of the committee addressing the issues from my committee, in front of that committee, and so it remains to be seen. But I have a sense that we're going to get it done.
Well, Republicans have the votes. If you can get all the Republicans to agree to vote for it, how important was it for Donald Trump to come to Capitol Hill?
I think it was extremely important for him to come. Very clearly, he gave the sense that many of us have who are true conservatives that we'd like to go more, but we know we can't because we have various individuals with their specific needs from their district in our conference itself, and we only have basically the required amount. We could lose three votes, and that's all we could lose. So we know that Thomas Massie is not going to be voting for it. We also know in the Senate that it's not a foregone conclusion that they'll accept what we send over. So we tried to send it as solid as possible, hitting all the key issues that promote the growth of the economy, that keep the largest tax increase in history from going on at the end of this year by making the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act permanent, which impacts farmers, which impacts businesses, especially small businesses, which impacts middle-income families more than any other level, and still keeps in place the social safety net that's there, but make sure that we're not providing Medicaid to illegals or fully able-bodied people able to function. And so when I hear my Democrat colleagues talking about we're going to cut Medicaid and Medicare, it's just an absolute, and I'll call it for what it is, it's a lie. It's an attempt to promote fear, and that's not what we're doing. The president was very strong in his statement yesterday about no cuts to Medicare or Medicaid, and we hadn't planned on it. But dealing with waste, fraud, and abuse, that's another story. So I think most of my constituents, and I would guess that the majority of people in Michigan, if they understand the bill and understand in that area that it's waste, fraud, and abuse that we're going after, so you have more actual Medicaid revenue that can be used for people who genuinely need it and deserve it. And that's where we're getting at. But there's plenty of other things in the big, beautiful bill. But my area was education, specifically higher education, the high cost of higher education, and the unbelievable student loan debt that's mounting up to about $300 billion of lost revenue if we don't find a means by which we fix the program. And I think my bill does that. And we worked hard in our committee and pushed it out, and I believe it will not only help students and parents under the Parent Plus loans, which we put further restrictions on, but we also gave schools the opportunity to counsel their students for the first time on the basis of the major they're getting. I don't think you ought to take that level of loan because you won't be able to pay it off. Up until this bill, if it passes, college were prohibited from telling the students in a financial aid counseling session that their particular major would not cut it if they were going to take that level of loan. So now they can do that, and by putting caps on the maximum loans for undergrad, grad, and professional grad, like medical doctors, and putting them at a very reasonable spot where the majority of students, I think, in Michigan, and I know in my district, won't hit those caps, I think we're going to encourage colleges and universities to not just assume that the government's going to continue to pay these loans and so you can keep increasing your tuition. And so we'll see what happens.
You talked about Democrats trying to scare people. The one thing that scares congressional members is the possibility of not getting reelected. Some Republicans are in some close districts, some tough districts. Did they promise their voters that they were going to come to Congress and eliminate spending? Are they worried that there's too much spending in the big bill, or is it spending on the wrong things?
Well, it's the individual items. For instance, some of our members who represent districts in New York and California that were districts won by President Biden, they're on a hot seat. But I'd rather have them there than a Democrat sitting in that spot, because they 70-80% of the time are voting with us and on fiscal policy issues as well. But the salt tax credit that's there, we don't have that in our state, and so we're expected to pay to cover the high state and local taxation that's going on in New York, for instance. I don't think that's right, but a New York colleague of mine is going to be hard-pressed if he or she is representing Brooklyn area,
right?
And they're going to have to cut. And so we had to work out an agreement. I think the speaker has done it, where we won't continue to pay at the level we are now, but there will be some left over to assist the taxpayers.
Right. All right. Well, we'll see if we get a vote today. Tim Wahlberg, working hard, working early, working late. Appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. Welcome back to All Talk. A stunning development in one of Michigan's most closely watched cold cases. Charges have been dropped, apparently, for now, against the stepson of a man accused of murdering Dee Warner, a Lenawee County woman who disappeared more than 3 years ago. Prosecutors say they plan to refile the charges, citing a key witness who could not be located before the scheduled hearing. What's next in the search for justice for Dee Warner, and what does the latest twist mean for the family that's never stopped seeking answers? Joining us now is Todd Flood of Flood Law. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Kevin. I'm great. Thanks. How are you?
Good. Tell us your role in this case.
Well, it first started with the declaration of death trial, because Dee's body was missing. There wasn't a declaration of death. You couldn't move forward in the probate matter. So we did a trial to show that she, in fact, wasn't missing. She was deceased. That trial took place in front of Judge Sala. We won. Judge Sala, in her opinion, clearly stated that the only motive or the only person to gain from this was that of Dale, the husband. Shortly thereafter, the prosecutor's office levied charges against Dale for open murder, which then they had a preliminary exam. At that preliminary exam, the judge found probable cause to believe that a crime was committed and that Dale committed it, the murder. Then, shortly after that, the body was found. Dee was found in a fertilizer tank, one that was re-soldered and painted and tucked away, she was strangled to death. So move fast forward that we work on getting that amended death certificate to homicide strangulation, death by strangulation. And the prosecutor's office, although they did drop the charge currently on the son, that's going to move forward. I'm certain that they will bring that back. And then we today have filed our lawsuit against Dale for the wrongful death of Dee, so that the children, so that he doesn't stand to gain financially from Dee's death. And there's, you know, over $1 million in assets and cash that belong to the children and to, you know, to her offspring. And that is what we did today. We've been working on this case from close to the very beginning, and it is something that, you know, the family doesn't want. They want to live a quiet life, but every time this turns around, there's something new here. So we really want to just bring justice for these children and the loss of their mother and this brutal, brutal murder of their mom.
Talk us through the legal decisions that prompted prosecutors to drop the charges against Jaron Warner.
So, obviously, there is a witness issue. I don't know much more than that. From my understanding, that they have a witness that's going to basically be someone that's necessary and a necessity for the exam, for the preliminary exam. So just because they dropped it doesn't mean that there isn't probable cause to move, you know, a case forward. It just means at this time they don't want to screw things up. They want to do it right. And that witness is a key witness for the preliminary exam, and they want to freeze that testimony. One of the things you do when you hold an exam is you put the, we call it the testimony in cement. so that it can be used later on at times of trial. And that's is a necessity often, if not most of the time, when you have a key witness. So my guess of things is that they want to make sure that they have that witness buttoned up. It could just be that he's out of town or she's out of town, and they want to take it to make sure that they had to adjourn it, or the judge wouldn't adjourn it. So they want to, all right, they'll dismiss and then reissue it a later time.
So it doesn't sound like this is a witness who came forward and then changed their story or decided they didn't want to testify. More of a witness that isn't available currently. Why an unnamed witness? Doesn't the defense have a right to know who the witnesses are?
Sure. So they have a witness list, and who's going to testify at the preliminary exam. Whether or not the witness is available or not available ultimately will come out, you know, for the defense to know about so that the defense can cross-examine that witness at a later date. But it may just simply be logistics and taking that in full account, you know, if it's a logistical thing, you know, what's your big cross-examination? You weren't available because you were out of the country or you're on vacation or you were whatever. I mean, that's no nefarious act. So the fact of the matter is that when it comes time, the defense will have that information for sure.
Feels so bad for the children. They lost their mother in a horrible murder. And it seems like they've had to do all the work to try and find out what's going on. Has law enforcement been pulling their weight, or is this something that private investigators have been uncovering new evidence?
I think twofold here. Law enforcement, definitely. We used them in our declaration of death trial, and I'm telling you, the weight of what they did and the work they did was amazing. You know, to show that she wasn't missing. I mean, we had Secret Service, we had Michigan State Police, we had some great, great law enforcement. And I think, you know, I always say this about being a prosecutor. You want to, you know, measure twice, cut once. You want to do it. You got one shot at this, and you want to do it right, and you have to do it right. On the other side, the victims, these children, yes, they have put up a lot. They offered a reward, the children did. They did a lot of publicity. They've been doing a lot of work. They had their own private investigators help. They had a team of lawyers. You know, here's the thing. You will very seldom, if ever, see a declaration of death trial. We did that. I mean, that they just don't occur, right? Because normally a catastrophe happens, a plane goes down, there's, you know, a missing body. You need a declaration of death, you know, so you can open up the estate and start to work on the estate. Some catastrophe happens, you know, that's one way. Here, where there was a missing body, and no claim that you could open up the estate, you had to have a trial. And we did it within 5 years. The statute you know, points to that. That's what we did. And our burden was really heavy. We had the second highest burden in all of law. We had to prove by clear and convincing evidence that Dee was in fact dead, not just missing. And that was done both by private and law enforcement. And I give a lot of kudos to law enforcement because, you know, they're hamstrung. They're not allowed to talk about what they have. They're not allowed to go out and do the press conferences about this is, you know, the evidence A, B, C, and D. They're hamstrung on that, especially when it's an open and active case.
Well, Tipton's such a small town. I'm sure they don't see a lot of this in Tipton. How has the community been through all of the twists and turns? Have they been supportive of the kids?
Yes. Yes, they have. His family's, you know, they want closure. This has been going on for 3 years, right? They want to be able to mourn in a way that this is not some celebrity show. So the town has been, Adrian and Tipton, they've been Tecumseh, they've all been very supportive of the family. And mm-hmm. when I go out there to this small cafe and have a cup of coffee there, you know, it's a close-knit community, a lot of love, a lot of support for the family. It's beautiful to see. You're right. They don't see this happen.
Yeah.
Quite candidly, these cases thankfully are rare, but they do happen, obviously in the bigger cities.
Right. Todd Flood, attorney, Flood Law, thanks for bringing us up to date on this, and we will check back in with you. We appreciate you.
Kevin, I appreciate you, my friend. Be well.
All right, you too. That's going to do it for All Talk. Paul W. Smith in Focus is next.